Leviticus 16, 18. Mr. Weaver, would you like to begin? 16, 18.
Come to it, the altar which is before the Lord, and he shall make a turn upon it. He shall take some of the blood of the young bull, some of the blood of the goat, and place it now down.
Yes. And he shall go out. And now this W-Yasa. Now that's, what form would that be with the wow? It's what verb is it first? Yasa, to go out, yes, a very common verb. And it is what tense?
Cal
perfect, that's right. But you translated it future. Yeah. Stand by that? Good. Yes, it's we call it sometimes wow conversive. Now that's a strange expression, wow conversive. It gives the impression that the wow converts the perfect into an imperfect, and vice versa, the wow with the imperfect, the wow conversive with the imperfect changes it into a perfect. Well, that's about what happens, but that's not exactly the way to look at it, I suppose, not a particularly scientific way. They call up other names now. The wow with the imperfect is usually called now the wow consecutive. That's what you have learned. The wow with the imperfect, wow consecutive. And the wow with the perfect, the wow consecutive also. That is to say, these things are usually used in sequence. And the claim is, in sequence, you have a perfect first, followed by a bunch of wow consecutives with the imperfect. And vice versa, you may have an imperfect first, followed by a series of wow consecutives with the perfect. Well, this tells you what it is, but doesn't exactly tell you why. That's a rather peculiar situation. There was a view on this that just goes back to Driver, a driver whom you have heard about before. S.R. Driver, his famous introduction to the literature of the Old Testament. He also wrote a book on the use of the Hebrew tenses. And this was his analysis. Well, it's an analysis that you might get just from looking at the Hebrew. But you find, strangely, that the form, I'll use the verb katal, the form katal, yiktal, like that, in Ugaritic, there are no vowels in Ugaritic. I say that's not quite true. There are three forms of an allophant in Ugaritic. One with an A vowel, one with a D vowel, and one with an I vowel that are distinguished by different kinds of cuneiform marks. And it's not certain whether it's an A vowel before the aleph or after the aleph, or either one, say. But at least there are some places where you get a good idea in Ugaritic what vowel is being used. And if you have a vowel like this, why it's not at least it's not a silent schwa. So the form, the vowels here, I won't write in. There, some of them are clear, but some of them are debatable. But this form, which we would call yiktol, and which we would call future, is oftentimes in the Ugaritic a straight past tense. And if you look at the Psalms, in particular Hebrew poetry, not only in the Psalms but Hebrew in general, you will find every once in a while a form like this, a yuktol, that is used in what seems to be a strict past tense. Now, why is it a strict past tense? Well, in Ugaritic, it seems that there are two forms, one that has a vowel here, and the other that has a schwa there, silent schwa. So one is yuktol, and one is yakatal, yakatala or something. Now, that's not absolutely certain. There seems to be two forms in the Ugaritic differing only in that vowel. At least there are two forms that don't differ much. And one seems to be used like the Hebrew imperfect, and the other seems to be used like the Hebrew perfect. And in the Hebrew, you have also this unexplained use of yiktol in past time. Now, Driver, of course, saw that. and he had to explain it. So he explained it as a repetitive past time. It was always going. So it was a repetitive use of this imperfect. And this repetitive use of the imperfect, one of his best examples was that in Genesis, get the verse, but you know it. In Genesis 2, it says, a mist went up to water the earth. See, the repetitive mist went up. It's past time. But it was a repeated thing. And so the repeated or incomplete action. So this tense, according to him, would be used usually present future, but sometimes past in repetitive or incomplete action, and therefore he called it imperfect, not present future. That's where the word imperfect comes from, you see. Now, of course, this example from Genesis is a particularly bad example because it doesn't mean missed after all. And we don't know that it went up day after day. It apparently is referring to irrigation. Not a mist went up, but water swelled up in irrigation, but still in past time. So the usages where he finds a repetitive or finds an incomplete action quite possibly are not to be interpreted that way, but should be interpreted as a hangover from an old past usage. You see the point? These psalms and so on with yiktol in the past should simply be taken as a narrative past tense, and as a hangover from the old form, which is well witnessed in Ugaritic. Now, in that case, the wow, if you put a wow on there, it doesn't convert anything. The wow is just says, and he goes on, uses the past time. The wow is just there because it's in a sequence. So it is possible that the well, now it is possible that the peculiar use of the well, you remember it's got a top and the next letter doubled, it's possible that that preserves an old difference between the vowel here and the vowel here. It might be that it preserves that old Ugaritic usage, you see. Well, the history of it, I suppose, we're not too concerned with, but I think you should remember that a yiktol, imperfect, doesn't always mean future present time. It doesn't always mean repetitive past time. It just says it's narrative. It's narrative past. Well, here, of course, we don't have that. I get a little off the subject. Wuyasa, this doesn't explain what the imperfect with, what the well consecutive or well conversive, whatever, with the perfect. How does it arise? And the answer is, we just don't have time to take that up today. Which means I don't know, and I don't think anybody knows. I said someplace recently, and say it again here, I think that still the use of the Hebrew tenses is one of the big problems of Hebrew grammar. Now, mostly you can get it from the context anyhow, so you don't have to worry too much about it. And a lot of people will tell you that the Hebrew doesn't have tense, it has aspects. Well, that was Driver's idea. And there may be some truth to it, I don't know. You don't have to have a language with tenses. But at least you did it rightly. It is a perfect, and it is a wow, a shua. Of course, the wow with the perfect is always shua. It never has a pat under the next letter double, you know, the way it does with the imperfect. So you're right, and he shall go out unto the altar, which is before the Lord. Now the next word, wakipper, and you translated that, and he shall make an atonement, didn't you? Wakipper. And they have the same wow. What tense is this? It's the root kafar, obviously. PL perfect, yes. PL perfect, kipper. Now, this verb, of course, requires a lot of interpretation. What does it mean? You translated it, atone. In what sense does it mean atone? Have you heard the statement that this word comes from the root kafar, which basically means to cover. You heard that? And that in the Old Testament time, sins were just covered. They weren't really atoned for. They weren't really, it was only when Christ came that the sins were atoned for. They were in the meantime, just you might say, covered up. What do you think of that? Got any ideas on that? Does that sound like the Old Testament theology? Where I think some of you asked me that question the other week, didn't you? What was the attitude of the people in the Old Testament time? Did they feel that they were atoned, that they were cleansed? Did they feel forgiven? Did they have a right to feel that they were now forgiven and confessed their sins and come to the temple? No. I said they did, didn't I? Well, that doesn't sound as if it was just covered up. Well, the question comes up here about the meaning of the word kippur, doesn't it? And now the question for us is, how will we find the meaning of the word kippur? We will first go and see what it comes from, and then we'll see if we can find the parallel for it in Arabic, and then we will know. Right? Good question. What did I say about Arabic? Well, this does have a root in Arabic.
It has a root in Arabic, APR, and it means to cover.
That's true. But does that mean much? There are two things to consider. One is that this is a PL. And the other thing is that the Arabic is not a very good parallel anyhow. The word is not used in the Old Testament, in the PL, in any other context but atoning for sin. You could check that. You could check it even in the Young's Concordance. I suggest that the Englishman's Hebrew Concordance or any good concordance, you probably would check it on your computer. But at least you can check kippur, and it is always in the PL. It is always used to refer to atonement for sin. That being the case, you would have to question whether or not it really means cover, even if it meant cover originally. See, words are used in a sense sometimes different from what they originally meant. A word gathers meaning in a particular, especially in a religious sense. And so, when it is used universally for atonement for sin, you better look to the context to see what the atonement was, what the atonement meant, and then interpret the word rather than vice versa. Well, the question does come up, why is it used in the PL? What is the use of the PL? What is the meaning of the PL in Hebrew? Anybody? Intensification. Oh, intensification. Is that right? What else does it mean? What?
Causative.
Yes. What does it mean when we say kippur? He said, what does kippur mean? Does it mean he spoke loud? Intensively? Not exactly. It just means speak, doesn't it? Yeah. Why is it used in the PL? Well, I'll tell you.
Because usually, you know,
a noun is derived from a verb. This is a common thing. But there are places where the verb is derived from the noun. And there is a noun, you may have heard of it. Dabar. Right? And dabar is a very common noun. And from the noun dabar, you get a verb here. So we call this usage a denominative usage. The denominator comes from a noun. The denominative usage of the PL. And that's a pretty important usage of the PL. The denominative usage of the PL. And Dibber is a good example of it. Well, is there a noun that has something to do with atonement? Anybody? By the way, I have here a special offer from E.J. Brill in libraries, and I find that you can get a copy of Keller Baumgartner. I said the other day I wasn't sure whether Keller Baumgartner's second edition was still available. The third edition, I told you, is all German and much superior to the second edition. But I recommended the second edition, which also has the English. The third edition doesn't. And I see that Brill has it available at the price of $55. That's right. Now, wait a minute. It's a reprint. I guess 55. No, it's $84. No, the special price is $55. Now, whether that's special price only at libraries, I don't know. And I don't know that I would advise you to get it for this class or anything, but I think that at least it is still in print, I will say that. Well, I'm not looking to that for the meaning here, but there is a noun, Koper. And from the noun Koper, you would expect the denominator. So then all we need to know is find the meaning of the noun, right? Well, the meaning of the noun is atonement. Or it means also ransom. You will pay a ransom to placate, to make somebody's face, the idea is to make somebody's face favorable. So a kofer is a payment to reconcile. Nothing about covering. You don't whitewash a person's face. It is an atonement. And that atonement, the pale, then, would be derived from the noun. And it means not to cover, but to atone. The meaning kafar, to cover, apparently comes from a parallel to the Arabic. I told you the Arabic much later, and not to be trusted. Now, to make it complete, I must say that there is a word, kafar, in the cow, which is used, I think, twice or three times, only in the kafar. In the Genesis account of the flood, kish. You know, kish seems the vessel, but you should kafar. And that does have an Akkadian equivalent, which means pitch, bitumen. They use bitumen, bitumen, the tar, in ancient times. Or we use it for glue. They used it to glue in a statue for the eye. They would glue in sometimes shells, two shells glued together, and it would make it look like a slit of an eye. So they use bitumen rather commonly in the Near East. It seems there are deposits of petroleum products in the Near East. They discovered in more recent times. So there is that word pitch, but it apparently has nothing to do with the verb, our verb. It would be kofar two, it would be kofar one. So two different roots. A lot of places have two different roots that look alike in Hebrew. So I think what I've said already still obtains, even though there is this word kafar pitch, you have the verb kafar to pitch, which is used, by the way, in the cow. So I say that here you have a noun kofar, and the verb kipper. And just one more thing to remember. The noun kofar has derived, not from this, but from the verb to atone, there is another noun derived. And that is kipora. Kipora, that is derived from the tail, from the verb. And kipora, they have these three words in a family. One is the noun, a ransom. The other is the verb to atone, to give a ransom for atonement. And the last, kipora, is the word which is used for the place where you do this. King James calls it mercy seat. the lid above the ark where you sprinkle the blood on the Day of Atonement is called in the Hebrew, and kapharet is not just a lid of a box, it is a place where atonement is made, probably feminine abstract. The T on the end makes it feminine abstract, probably. The place where atonement is made, and this is, in the Septuagint translated, the last area. Hilasterion, which is Christ is called the Hilasterion in the book of Romans. Christ is the mercy seat, the place of atonement. There in the Greek, quite clearly I'd say, Christ is identified with the great procedure of the sprinkling of the blood in the Day of Atonement, in the Day of Atonement Yom Kippur. Or the Bible has Yom Kippurim. So there's quite a story in this word, Kippur, isn't there? And maybe something of method, too. So he is to make atonement. Well, did we? We finished the verse, I think, didn't we? But this is verse 18 we're working on. Anything else to speak of in the verse you've got? And you make atonement for it, and you finish that. You take up some of the blood. You say some of the blood because this is a participle. Yes, some of the blood, and some of the blood of this, and some of the blood of that. And it shall give it upon the horns of the altar. Put it upon the horns of the altar. The word "nathan," of course, doesn't only mean give, put, place, whatever. Put upon the horns of the altar roundabout. That is, there are four horns to the altar. And I suppose it's not the blood roundabout, it's the horns roundabout the altar, which are sprinkled with the blood. Yes, any question on that? Okay. I think we go right ahead with the next verse. Next verse. Mr. No. That's not him.
And he shall sprinkle some of the blood on him with his finger seven times, and cleanse it, and consecrate it from the impurities of the sons of Israel.
Yes, that would be a strict reading of the verse. This word, hizah, what is that word, hizah? First word. Ephiel? Yes, what is the verb again? Nazah. And it means to sprinkle. Well, I guess there's not much question about that, is there? 19a, the footnote A. Verse 19 is deleted in the footnote. Most of you have a Stuttgart Bible? You have Kennel? Uh-huh. Do you have a footnote there? In 19a, the footnote in Stuttgart, it says verse 19, and then has a little mark less than, is deleted, that means. This verse 19 is deleted, and then you have a Gothic C. A Gothic C. That Gothic C means the Geniza of the Synagogue of Cairo. And there were manuscripts found in the Synagogue of Cairo by Schechter in the early part of this century. And some of them have parts of the Pentateuch. I don't think it's complete, and of course they're not real early. The synagogue, I think, would be around 1000 A.D. So they're not much earlier than other manuscripts, but they come from a different source, you know, and they do represent some slight differences. A lack of it in the Qumran manuscripts would be much more significant. The lack of it in the Cairo manuscripts is not particularly significant, I think. It's that he would do this is kind of clear from the context anyhow. So that footnote is just to be concerned, referred to, but only not for any particular purpose, I think. He shall sprinkle. Well, it would be off of it. This word is used in a very peculiar situation over in Isaiah 52:13. Isaiah 52:13. He shall sprinkle many nations, you know. And the question is, the subject differs a little bit, but I think that would take us too far afield and doesn't directly concern this verse. So this is the work of the high priest. You sprinkle with his finger some of the blood here, some of the blood there, seven times before the Lord. Now, he shall cleanse it and shall sanctify it from the defilement of the sons of Israel. I don't think I'll say much about that now, but tell you to watch out for this idea. What was the high priest doing? There are two views. The one view that's rather normal and usual among evangelicals, but there is another view that is advanced, and that other view is that the high priest here was not cleansing the people of their sins, but that he was cleansing the tabernacle and its furniture. And even the view is sometimes given that he was cleansing their word is de-sinning the tabernacle and its furniture, so that the high priest could go in without being killed. I mean, there were demons there. There was supernatural power, and you had to get rid of this, you know, and so you sprinkle it and cleanse it, and then you can go in. And this view is given in Martin Note's book, of course, quite definitely from the naturalistic point of view. It is alluded to some extent, I think I would say, in the view in the book of Wenham, the book on Ezekiel, the commentary on the Leviticus by Wenham, where he distinguishes between the sin offering and the guilt offering. And he claims that the sin offering is one of purification, and the guilt offering is one of freedom from sin. Now he goes, his commentary, of course, is longer than my contribution in here. He goes to some length on this. You might want to read what he has to say in this is the NICOT, New International Commentary on the Old Testament, the Ergman series. And Wenham is the author, and it's a very good commentary in general. But this idea, I want you to keep in mind as you go through this section. What was he doing? Was he really cleansing? Was he dealing with the sins of the people? Or was he dealing with uncleanness of the objects? It makes quite a difference in the theology. Of course, I conclude that he was dealing with the sins of the people. But watch for it as we go along. I think this is not the best place to finish up the argument. Several verses here bear on the subject. That's 19. Okay, 20? 20? Mr. Kim? Sundan Kim?
The kill. Okay.
Well, you just have a wow, don't you, there? Now, the wow just means and, doesn't it? Is it right? Is that right? Does wow just mean and? What else does wow mean? So, what else does it mean? But? Yeah. Now you say all that, and in a sense you're right. But maybe you look at it a little bit different way. The Hebrew doesn't say when or but or and so. The Hebrew says this and this and this and this and this. Whether it means when or so or but or if or and, see. The English, on the other hand, is not paratactic, but hypotactic, we say. It has ranks. it has words to tell you which is the first and which is the consequence and which is next and so on. So we don't really have to say that wow means all these things, but they string all these things together and we interpret it. And of course they did too. To them. They didn't say and. It meant to them what it means to us, but they express it in that paratactic form. So I don't object to your translation. I just kind of call attention to an example here of the Hebrew usage. So here you could say when, because apparently there is a conclusion. The conclusion is the next wow. Then he shall offer or bring near. The word is bring near the live goat. Now he brings near the live goat, offers the live goat. Karav can mean offer. We had korban, which means a gift, an offering. So you can translate that, he shall offer the live goat, but he didn't offer it on the altar, of course. The live goat was offered in a different way, wasn't it? So maybe you should say he just brings near the live goat and goes ahead with the ceremony. Perhaps is what it is here. I guess no other comment there. Yes. Paratactic. Paratactic. That's a term. It comes from the word parataxis. Taxis, you have the word taxonomy and so on. This is a Greek word, you see. This means side by side. So parataxic. And the word, other word was pupotactic. English, not Greek. Pupotactic. This comes, of course, the Greek pupa underneath, rank by ranking. Yes. You said the holy place. Yes, the holy place and the temple of the and the tent of meeting and the altar. Yeah. Now, what is the holy place if not the tent of the meeting? Yeah. That's your point.
That and what you were just saying about the making atonement
yes.
for the objects.
Yes. And see here. Yes. When he is finished, when he is finished from doing this, this is the min, by the way. This is not a PL participle. Understand? Mikkaper. No, the infinitive, of course, wouldn't have a. Well, it's the infinitive with min. Yes, it's not the PL participle. It's a min with the verb. So when he is finished with this, with doing this, and what he is doing is atoning. In one sense or another, atoning the sanctuary. Now you could say the sanctuary that is the Ohel Moed and the Mizbeach, or you could say the holy things, the holy area, and the temple, tabernacle, and the altar. The whole thing is included. We have the sign of the accusative here: eth, eth, and eth. Later on, we will have an F and an L, a lamin, to worry about. Now, here the question is whether Kodesh includes the other two. And I think I would say, as far as the Hebrew is concerned, you could say so. Or whether it is the inclusive term for the whole sanctuary, a part of which was the temple and a part of which was the altar. And, of course, remember there was the basin and there was the courtyard and the whole business, you might say. So, I think I would say that the Kodesh here is not exactly equal to the Ohel Moed. The Ohel Moed would only be part of the business.
But is he making atonement for those things? Is he cleansing them?
He's cleansing them in one sense of the word, yes. Now, that sounds like what I've just objected to.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, well, keep that in mind. Sounds like Wenham didn't say what he said without some reason. I may feel that there are other reasons, but he had a reason. It sounds as if he is descending these things. Mm-hmm. Well, keep that in mind. what to keep in mind is that here kippur is used with a direct object. Right? We will find kippur used with other prepositions. Let's see if there's difference in usage there. Mm-hmm. Yes, question.
Along that same line, back in verse 18, where it says, shall make atonement unless he says to pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
If he wanted.
Yes. In verse 17, we didn't have to do 17, but verse 17 says, and every man shall not, that is, no man shall be in the Ohel Moed, in the tabernacle, when he, the high priest, comes to make an atonement in the holy place until he goes out, and he shall make an atonement ba'atho, for himself, and ba'ath ba'atho, his house, and ba'ath all the children of Israel, all the congregation of Israel. Now here, the high priest is making atonement, and the word kafar is used, and it is used with persons. And here the preposition there is ba'ath. So atonement for, is there a difference in meaning between atonement for ba'ath, or atonement of accused it? There, so far, here, in these two places, you could make that difference. Well, would that difference work the rest of the chapter? Is a question, see. That's why I say keep these things in mind as we go on and see if we can come to some conclusion about whether he is merely de-sinning objects or whether he is offering for sins. Now, of course, we can't say that the tabernacle and its work is all tainted with the people whom it serves, the priests who work in it, who were by no means perfect people. So in a sense, we may say that it needed cleansing and purification. But the atonement here, for the sake of, seems to be for the sake of the sins of the people. The tabernacle doesn't sin. But the tabernacle is the tabernacle of the sinful people. So, maybe we can say some of both, that maybe we have to keep both those thoughts in mind. Well, verse 21, we've come that far, I think, haven't we? 21, Mr. Kim Hwan-jung.
And Aaron must lift his both hands to the head of the blood goat. You must confess all of the iniquity of the sons of Israel and all of their rebellions. And he must be there on head of both,
yes.
He must then be there. Then who is in business and into the business?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Some act just place his hand on the head of the goat. What does it mean when Aaron put his hand on the put his two hands, I guess here's an important point for some of you fellows coming up before presbytery. When you're going to be ordained, you make sure that the presbytery puts both their hands on you. You get a lot of fellows around, sometimes only one hand. No, it's a symbolism, of course. The symbolism is quite clear, isn't it? The identification of the priest and with the sin that he's working on. He's confessing, and his hand touches the head of the goat. And it says, puts the sins on the head of the goat. So it's very clear. Now, remember, I think we said that this ritual of putting hands on the sacrifice is common. You have it in the burnt offering. You have it also, I believe, in the fellowship offering. It's natural. There, it is not explained. But here, it is explained that it is not just touching for fun, not petting the animal. You're putting your hand on the animal and thereby transferring. It's the clearest possible picture of substitution, substitutionary atonement. So he puts both hands on the head of the animal, the goat, the live goat. Now, this hith-wed-da, what is this word, hith-wed-da, Mr. Kim? Where does it come from?
Yada.
Yada, yes. That means to confess, right? But what stem is it? Hith-pael, yes. Now, notice the hith-pael, hith-wed-da. How do you get a wow out of a yod? Well, that's not a very good question. I got the question wrong. The question is, how did you get a yod out of a wow? See, the verb is wayada. 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 Of course, a lamate verb, the ending goes off sometimes. And here you have when the yod, not wayada, sorry, wada, wada. And when a wow in Hebrew is initial, it is usually changed into a yod. A word in Hebrew that should begin with a wow changes to a yod. Give you an example. What does the word yelet mean? Boy. Yeah. In Arabic, I'm not using Arabic for meaning, but for her grammar here, the word for boy in Arabic is walid. Walid. The wow. And in a number of other examples you had, I think it's very clear and admitted by everybody, that in yada, the original word, the original letter, would be wow, not yod. But at the beginning of a word, or sometimes the beginning of a syllable, even, it changes to yod. And so what you have here is the more original form of yada. It's the form yada that you have to explain. This one is regular. And the hith pael has a tendency to be regular because, you know, it's got the hith in front, it's got the double middle radical and all, it keeps everything regular. So this is, he confesses, the meaning is clear. But you might say that the meaning of the hith pael is very appropriate here, isn't it? Confession. Like your Greek middle means confession for yourself. He's confessing, he's not just saying something into the blue, he's putting himself into it there. The hith pael is not always used reflexively, however. I should remark that the hith pael is used sometimes reflexively, but many times it is a straight passive. When it's a straight passive, it acts just about like the nithel. So the word is confess, you have it quite right, and it's from yada. And he confessed, probably confessing over it because he has his hands on the head of the animal. See, he confesses over it, over the animal, that is, all the iniquities of the sons of Israel and all their transgressions. Now, all the iniquities of the sons of Israel and all their transgressions, this is accusative, right? This is a straight accusative. But then the next, the L, lekol chataoth, that is a lamet. And how did you handle that? You said transgress. That he confessed over it all the iniquities of the sons of Israel and all their transgressions. And then what did you say? For lekol chataoth. How did you translate that? I don't remember. All of their sins. Yes. How did you translate the L? The lamet would be the question, wouldn't it? And the question is this three things? Their iniquities, anah, and their transgressions, peshah, and sins, hataotham. Is it three things? Or is it, I think the NIV says, their iniquities and their sins with, their transgressions, with all their sins, doesn't it? What's Yeah, not be said there.
No with.
Just
dash.
Oh, that's right. Dash. All their sins. Which more or less makes it inclusive. See, this covers the iniquities, the transgressions, all their sins. Was somebody writing on all the words for sin? Thinking about it. Thinking about it. Don't forget this verse. Well, that's a possibility. That's what the NIV has chosen. Now, there is another possibility that I would mention, and that is that the lameth here is a straight accusative. Have you come across the accusative use of the lameth? Well, you know, surely you know by now, that prepositions are a real problem in any language. What is the exact meaning of a preposition? I put the book on the desk. I write something on the wall. The German has two different prepositions for that. They'll say on for one and auf for the other. I never can remember which. Two different prepositions. We were doing some painting in our house. My son was here and doing some painting. And he covered over the ceiling. Well, how do you cover over the ceiling? You cover under the ceiling, don't you? How do you put that? Well, you know, the expression is that way. And one preposition used in a dozen different ways. And this is true also in Hebrew. And I think we must be careful not to force too much. The preposition has to mean this, has to mean that. The lameth, you can give names for it. The indirect use of the lameth, you know, give something to somebody. Or the general reference with regard to somebody. You can give names for them, but the fact is these prepositions are used in different ways. And there are numbers of examples where the lameth is just used as a strict accusative. There are other places, by the way, where the lameth is used now to mean from. That might surprise you. You have heard that. The lameth sometimes means from. That is proved from Ugaritic study. I think it is well understood now. If you want some further points on this, there is a section in Dahud. Dahud's commentary on the Psalms in the Anchor Bible series. You know the Anchor Bible series? Now, that's a liberal series, but it's a competent liberal series. You can learn from it. Some liberal series you don't learn much from. This one, I think you do. And Dahud, I think I would say Dahud was a Christian. He was Catholic, an earnest man, and though he had some views I'm sure we wouldn't appreciate, and I don't think he believed the Bible to be verbally inspired, nonetheless, I think he felt that it was a real revelation from God, And so I think I would say that he was Christian, though I'm fortunately not his judge. Elmer Smick of Gordon Seminary has had a good bit of contact with Dahud, thought very highly of him. Dahud is sometimes thought to be very extreme in his views, comes to his conclusions, so don't believe everything Dahud says, but give him attention. In his third volume of the Anchor Bible on the Psalms, he has at the end what he calls the Hebrew grammar. Now, it's like no usual Hebrew grammar that you have seen. But he gives there, in synopsis form, with references, some of the weird ideas that he has used in interpreting the Psalms. He says, this verse is like the Phoenician so-and-so, you know. He's quite an expert in positions, Phoenician and Ugaritic. And he has numbers of places, and we'll give you references, where lama means from, and also bait. Bait means from, both of which, of course, 50 years ago, nobody would have said. So it is possible that the lama here is a straight accusative equal to the two other Fs. Now, that's not necessary, not even perhaps usual, but lama does mean accusative sometimes. And in particular, it means that in Aramaic. And therefore, critics for years have said that lameth accusative is an indication of lateness. And Aramaism and lateness, What have I told you about lateness and Aramaisms? I told you that they don't count anymore. Right? And when you read some book that this is an Aramaicism and late way, you look at the date and you'll find it's earlier than 1925. So it could be. It could be a straight accusative here parallel to the other rests. But on the other hand, it wouldn't have to be, and it might be that the NIV is correct, that it is more or less inclusive. Their transgressions, their sins, their transgressions, all their sins. That, of course, is the main thing that is intended to include. It doesn't say this kind of a sin, and this kind of a sin, and that kind of a sin, and no others. This is intended to include all their sins. Will be put on the head of the live goat. And all their sins and all their transgressions, and shall put them, not then put or give, upon the head of the goat, and he shall send it in the hand of this word itti. What is your translation of itti? A man was a witness?
In readiness.
A man in readiness. Yes, I suppose that's all right. It's hard to know. Just what, an ishi itti. It comes from what word? What other word is like it? What word is it related to? Common word. I think itti is only used here, isn't it? But it is the word eight. Right? Eight or itta. Either form. And eighth means time. And therefore people said timely, a man who is in readiness, a man who happens to be right here, such and such a man, whoever he is. The man, okay, we say the man of the hour. So, that's time also, isn't it? Yes, the King James says a fit man, an appropriate man, a ready man in readiness. What did the NIV say on that man?
The man appointed,
yes. That has a little bit different. The word eight also does mean appointed. They take a slightly different point of view, as it could be. But the man is not necessarily ordained. He's not a son of Aaron. He's just, he probably would be a Levite working in the temple. But he is just an appropriate man to go into the desert. Maybe he's strong enough to take care of the goat or something. So that time. So, it, by the way, the word itti has a double T, doesn't it? Itti. And any idea where that double T would come from?
You're looking for three letters in the Hebrew word, aren't you? What is the root of itti? I think you're in Lexicon, would give it under ana, and then ana, ayin, nun, T. Would take the N and assimilate it. So you would get it T. Now in Ugaritic, this is Ayin Nun T. And it does not assimilate. Because presumably there's some vowels in there. Ugaritic does assimilate sometimes, but apparently no vowels in that particular form. So there's an interesting case where the Ugaritic shows you what the root of the Hebrew is. Infer it anyhow, it makes it clear. So here's this man who sends it into the wilderness.
I have a question.
You have a question, and then others feel there's no time for the question, but go ahead.
What the actual nature of the content of the confession would be. We're talking about all their iniquities and transgressions.
Yeah.
But how would the priest actually go about it?
I mean, it might be a long list.
There might be something that you need to know.
Don't you ever pray for all the missionaries? Well, I'm sure he would not say, please, the sins of Brother Abraham, and the sins of Brother Jacob, and the sins of Brother so-and-so. I'm sure he would give all the list of all the sins. But he does make a, shall we say, a comprehensive all the types of sin, all the the outstanding sins, the outrageous sins, he would make them. And it is interesting, of course, that there's no formula of confession. It's to be inclusive. And that is an interesting thing to me. I think I've said it before. In all these motions that we have here, lay your hand on, do this, do this, do that. But there isn't anything there about the spoken ritual involved. There isn't any set pattern. He doesn't say, I will confess this and this and this and this. No, it's not that. It's the prayers are apparently spontaneous. And the confessions, presumably, are from the heart. But there were confessions, and there were prayers, and there were songs. But we don't have them. Of course, the songs later, we have the psalms. But the confession, I would say, was a heart confession of the priest for his people at the time. Okay, well, I was late 10 minutes, so I should rob you of your time. So come back, 5 to 10 minutes if possible, not over short. Sure.